good. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to come back. It was my first visit to Virginia. It's a beautiful area, and I really appreciate the opportunity to meet some of you folks, learn some of your production systems, and some of the problems that you have. It's my first time at this conference, and one of my observations is that you have too many speakers. And I say that because on Tuesday morning, we started off and there was a real simple equation that had like two variables that described how many calves we'd have. And every speaker added a new factor. And it just made it harder and harder and harder. And I'm wondering, how do we ever get any calves? No, but seriously, I think you should all be patted on the back because the conference has a lot of detail and a lot of depth to it. And when you think about, you know, the calving possibilities, that you do a great job of concentrating those calves, you know, getting tight calving group, matching them to your environment in a sustainable way. And as Dr. Cora talked about, you know, making a really great product that's really desired by the consumers, you know, both in the U.S. and the whole United States. So, you know, I think we have to look at that big picture and don't worry too much about all those factors in that equation. We somehow get the job done. So I wanted to talk about and share some of the information that we developed over in California. And where do we put that clicker?
That is a good clicker.
Up here. Okay. The work wasn't done on the beach. It was done up in far northern California, right along the Oregon border here. The beaches are down here about 700 miles away. It's actually an area more like Intermountain West, high mountain desert. We have different environment than you have. We do have fescue, but it's not endophyte infected. We have cattle that graze up in the mountains. We do have four seasons. They're probably a little more extreme, each of the seasons in your four seasons in Virginia, but on the other hand, not as extreme as Montana. All of the work that I've done occurred on commercial cow-calf operations, family-owned operations. The owner-managers were the guys doing the work and had been for a long time. In many cases, one of the ranches had been in the same family since the late 1800s. So management-wise, I think a lot of similarities, just trying to be a sustainable, profitable ranches and managing the cattle for that. I did say three ranches, Cowley Ranch, which we'll call Ranch A here for today, and the Cook, K-U-C-K, these gentlemen here, Ranch B, and the young guy with the sunglasses, Ranch C. We had also on the project is Christina Weber, Ph.D. Candidate. She's now Dr. Christina Weber, and Allison Van Enenam, biotechnology specialist on the Davis campus. I think we have a fairly robust data set, and by that I mean that we have three different ranches, and two of the ranches had both spring calving and fall calving herds, and for us, spring calving starts either January 1 in this ranch or early February, and our fall calving herds start in, you know, September, October. This ranch, Ranch C, only had fall calving and started about August 15th. And again, there's quite a bit of variation. Some of the ranches went, their calves summered up in the mountains, and others stayed down on the valley floor, summered in the mountains here. So quite a bit of variety between the ranches, a total of 15 calf crops, because the project was done over a three-year time period. And kind of a lot of information here, but the main thing, these are the EPD levels for the Angus bulls across all three ranches to kind of give you an idea of the type of bulls that were being used. Okay, the ranches were vertically integrated with Harris Ranch, which was a feedlot processor. And so the ranches tended to have more common goals than three ranches totally at random because they were working towards sort of the same goals there. And These are all the EPDs for the Angus bulls that were used, and there were some small, you know, statistically significant differences, but actually they were fairly uniform with the exception of scrotal circumference. Two of the ranches had given quite a bit of emphasis to scrotal circumference, and marbling here, one of the ranches had worked quite a bit on marbling. Other than that, the EPDs for the various Angus bulls across the three ranches was fairly similar, differing just in those two traits mainly and a little bit in some of the other carcass traits. The thing that was consistent across the three ranches, talking about that impact what we're talking about today, and that's the breeding seasons. And these were all multi-sire breeding pastures, and the ratio of cows to bulls was about 25 to 1 for all of the pastures. And the number of bulls varied. Some of the pastures were small with just two bulls per pasture. Others were larger, nine bulls per pasture, which would come out to, I think, a little over 225 cows. The bulls all passed their BSE exam during the breeding season. The owner-operators, the cattlemen, were out there, especially in the fall calving. They'd be feeding hay every day, so if bulls got injured, they'd be pulled. If they lost a lot of condition, they'd have to get pulled. The young bulls were not run with any of the older bulls. They were all run when yearling bulls were used. They were run together. And occasionally, bulls were moved between groups. This would usually be due to injury or lack of condition, and that's mainly because there weren't any extra bulls. Basically, there was nobody in the bullpen waiting to come out. They were at work. Okay, results. We're going to start just looking at the overall summary here of the reproduction part. And this first line in red, I've just combined all three ranches over all 3 years. So that'd be 15 calf crops. And for each calf, we obtained DNA from hair samples and used that to determine paternity for each one of the 5,000 calves. And the bull ages shown here, the youngest age was 1.3 years. We had an old timer, 11.6 years of age. The average age on the bulls was 4.4 years. And the overall mean was 18.9 calves per bull. So I just rounded off as a number to remember and say about 20 calves per bull is what we found across all the ranches. If we look at it by year and keep the ranches combined, there was no statistical difference, 19.9, 20.1, and 19.7 for each of the 3 years. And we also look at spring calving versus fall calving, very, very similar also, 20.5 calves per bull and 19.2 for the fall calvers. This column here is an interesting one. Minimum number of calves, it's labeled, and maximum number of calves. And what that means is simply gone through, and for the bull that had the largest number of calves in a single calf crop, one bull in one calf crop had 64 calves. Okay, and one bull, at least one bull, only had one calf in the calf crop. Now, what I haven't talked about here is we had 4.4% of the bulls had no calves. They were out there, and they were eating and doing everything else, but they had no calves. And actually, 4.4 is pretty close. There was a similar study done in Australia using DNA paternity testing, and that was in the northern part of Australia in the tropical area, more kind of outback-ish with Bos Indicus and Bos Indicus crossed cattle. And they found 6% of their bulls also had no calves. So I think we have to recognize that probably does go on. Okay, let's look at it on a calf crop basis. And I have the red is Ranch A, Ranch B, and then Ranch C. And you see there's some variation here about this 20 mean, 20 calves per bull mean. So these three columns refer to the per bull averages. But there's not a lot of variation. But I think the really interesting part is to look at these two columns again. Okay, so this would be for this calf crop, and for each of these calf crops, This would be the maximum number of calves born from a bull. And you can see that in almost every case, almost every calf crop, some bull distinguishes himself by having a large number of calves. In most cases, about twice the average, close to 40 calves. And similarly, despite the bulls all having passed their test, being in good condition, and according to experienced cattlemen, they should be out there doing their job, in every single calf crop, there is a good chance that some bulls only produced one or two or three bulls or calves. So there's quite a bit of variation in individual animal, even though a lot of the means and averages when you combine bulls show that there's a lot of consistency. And if we look at, again, at individual bull performance, this just shows the mean number of calves per bull per breeding season or per calf crop, and it shows the three ranches, and the variation, the average, as I said before, was about 20 calves per bull, but it ranges from a mean of one up to about 40. And it's really consistent across ranches. You can see the three different symbols there, that they're pretty evenly scattered, and they all have some that are up around 40, and they all have some down at the other end. I don't know if that's consistent variation or variable consistency. It's one or the other, but when we combine bulls, we see, you know, a lot of consistency in terms of 20 calves per bull, but there's a huge amount of variation per bull. And we'll delve down into that a little bit and look at some of the individual things that are going on here. We did also look at the bull age. And this graph has the age of the bull here and then the mean number of calves that the bulls had per calf crop. And while there's quite a bit of variation, if you look at it statistically, there is a significant curvilinear relationship with age, and maximum prolificacy came at about 5 years of age on these bulls. Okay, so quite a bit of scatter, but there is a statistical relationship there. This is that older bull. He's, you know, this is field data, and he just did really well. He's kind of an outlier. Okay, pounds of beef. That's what the ranch sells. That's what keeps you in business, whether you sell them as feeder calves or into the feedlot or retained ownership, whatever it is, it's pounds of beef that makes you your money. So let's look at that. This graph is kind of complicated, so I'll have to walk you through it here, but this is for weaning weight. So this would be adjusted weaning weights to 205 days of age, adjusted for the ranches and for sex. And let's start with this black line that goes right across here. This is the weaning weight, the individual 205-day weaning weights, the mean for the progeny from individual bulls across here. So each one of these dots would be the bull's mean of his progeny. And you can see they vary from about 400 pounds up to about 600 pounds. Now, if these calves were in a pen of cattle, or were in a pen, and you looked at those calves, you'd probably say, I really like those 600-pound calves. Those are a lot better than those 400-pound calves. I'd like to know who they're from. Well, we know who they're from because we have DNA on them, and we can match it up with the sire's DNA, and we can tell you who sired those 600-pound calves, and vice versa. You may want to know, well, I want to know who produced those 400-pound calves. But for the ranch, what's important is the total weaning weight, and that's this red line. That's all these red dots. And that's over here. That's the T205, or the total 205, and you have to multiply this scale by 20 because it's a lot more. So it's the result of the number of calves times the weight of the calf. Okay, and that's what that bull produces. And so you can see this is it drops on down. These bulls weren't producing much weight for the calf. They weren't contributing much to the ranch's income because they just didn't produce many calves. They actually, some of these bulls that had the higher weaning weights, you know, had really good weaning weights, but they didn't produce many calves. The calves are the blue bars, and that's over here. So you can see that the number of calves follows the total production quite closely. It's really not a surprise. You know, we have a lot of economic models that say reproduction is more important than growth, and this just kind of supports that. It's showing that the number of calves is far more correlated to the total production from that bull than the weaning weights. Okay, I won't spend a lot of time. This is basically the same slide, but this is for this is for a feeder value or the retained value. And this line across here is like weaning weight. This is the mean individual feeder value. So it's similar to the individual weaning weight. Significant variation between sires. But these lines down here, that's the total feeder value or the total retained value. And this is the number of calves. And again, you can see that whether you're talking about weaning weight, feeder value, or retained value, that the thing that's closely correlated, highly correlated, is the number of calves, not the individual performance of their progeny. Reproduction. Okay, we'll talk a little bit now about the calving distribution. This kind of show where these cattle were. This graph shows the week of the calving season on the x-axis here by 1 week intervals. And this is the cumulative percent of calves born. Many of you have seen these kind of graphs. Shows that after 21 days, 42% of the calves had been born. And by week 6, under our conditions of these three ranches, 75% of the calves had been born. So that's about 2 heat cycles to get to that point. But let's look at the individual ranches. Okay, that's the composite. So let's look at individual ranches now. And this is a week of the calving season along here. And each one of these lines is one of the calf crops. So this particular ranch, Ranch A, they had both spring and fall. And we had 6 years of data, so there are 6 lines. And the pattern, and we'll see this again, but the pattern shows that early in the calving season, it picks up, and by week 3, generally, is the peak number of calves born per week, and it drops on off, you know, following the breeding, as you would expect from the breeding season, and recognizing that by 42 days, 75% of the calves are born, so you would expect to see this sort of a pattern. But they do start off a little bit slowly and then build up. We saw that pattern with Ranch B, the second ranch, sort of the same sort of thing, starting off, peak calvings occurring at week 3. Not always that way, a little bit different at times, but generally that's the case. And the third ranch, Ranch C here, pretty much the same pattern. They only had fall calving here. All 3 of them the same. Now what I want to do is take that data that we talked about earlier. You remember this graph that was the mean number of calves that each of the bulls had. And we divided this into 3 groups. A higher prolificity group, a middle prolificity group, and then the lower guys that didn't produce as well. So we took that information and combined it with the 3 previous graphs. Okay, and put those together. And so for Ranch A, this is what we found. If we split out that calving distribution, again, here's week of the calving season, and this is the mean number of calvings, which reflect, you know, in general, the number of conceptions. And these would be the low prolificacy bulls and the number of calves they have each week during the calving season. And the blue line are the bulls that produced, you know, most of the calves, the high prolificacy calves, and this is the number of calves that they would have each week. So that's the pattern that we see for Ranch A, and it's very consistent for Ranch B, and the same thing for Ranch C. So we can combine those with this sort of a thing that adds the power of all the data together, and what it shows is that These low prolificity bulls, the bulls that, if you look at the whole calf crop, they produce very few calves. And they do so by only siring a few calves, 1 to 2 calves, you know, each week during the duration of the breeding season. And the high prolificity bulls, they sire a huge number more, significantly higher number of calves early in the calving season. And then later on, they sire about the same number. Okay, now, so the data indicates, you know, that these bulls that sire a lot of calves, that they do so early on. It doesn't say why they do it or how they do it, but there's obviously a large number of females in estrus that these guys are picking out and breeding compared to these folks down here, these bulls. It's interesting, though, that later in the calving season, well, that when there's not that many females in estrus, that they don't show that same differentiation. Those bulls obviously have whatever traits it is that's getting them to sire more calves. They're not exercising that later in the calving later in the breeding season. I don't know why that's the case, but that's what we saw. It also suggests that there may be some opportunities for management, since our calving, and that would reflect our breeding, starts off a little bit slowly, that maybe we could do some manipulation to move this ahead and get more calves earlier, which refers back to, you know, a lot of the discussions throughout the conference. And again, some of these cows that are calving out here, that we could maybe manipulate those to get those to calve earlier. The other thing that's of really critical importance is this greatly skews the genetic composition of the calves. So you have to hope that new bull that you just bought that's really high in marbling is going to generate a lot of CAB quality calves. You better hope that he's prolific, because if he's not prolific, you're not going to have very many calves out of him. So the prolificacy has a big impact on the genetic composition of the progeny. The other thing to think about is for folks that raise their own replacement heifers, where do we usually choose those replacement heifers? Which heifers become our replacements? The older ones, generally, right? Because we want to make sure that they'll get bred after we invest the time and money to raise them up to breeding age. And so those older ones come from where? They come from these calves in here. Okay, that's where most of those older ones are. So in reality, we're actually probably selecting replacement heifers that are from the more prolific bulls. And that's probably a good thing. We really don't know. I looked through the literature, and there's really not a lot of references to relationships between male fertility and female fertility, but we would think there might be. The other consideration that I think we might want to think about is not just this part, but those replacement heifers that are from these. We're going to still select a small number of replacement heifers from low prolificacy bulls, excuse me. And so even though those replacement heifers are older and maybe they get bred and calve early the first time, maybe they're not as fertile as those from the high prolificacy bulls. I don't know the answer to that, but it would be an interesting question to learn more about. Okay, we get a number of questions on you know, how many bulls or how many calves did some of the bulls sire per day, and we really don't have a real good answer on that, and all we have are actually calvings and not breedings. But just to kind of look at what we did get, and I don't think we really stressed this out or tried to test the maximum, but this just shows each one of these dots, you know, represents a sire's output, the number of calves he had born in a day. And so for us, you know, 10 to 11 is kind of the most that we had. If you look at individual bulls on this graph, there's five bulls listed over here. And this blue diamond bull 5-6, in this calf crop, he had 37 calves, and on one day, 11 of them were born. We don't know the breeding date exactly, but over a fairly large number, it probably averages out as a fairly representative day. His other days, you know, he just didn't breed that many. But it is interesting that on most of these bulls, there were individual days that, you know, generated a third of his full output occurred on one day. And that's not uncommon at all. You can see 10 out of 56, 10 out of 34 calves, 10 out of 25. And we can look at this red square bull, and he had 10 calves on that day, and very, very close, 8 calves, 10 calves. So there's quite a capacity there. And I'm not saying that this is any way proving how many they can have per day, but it's what we found, and people ask that question, how many did they have? Because of the importance of prolificacy, we took a look at, are there any EPDs related to that? And we looked at a whole number of EPDs and looked at scatter plots of them to see if there was any relationship, looked at correlations, regressions between single EPDs and prolificacy and multiple relationships. And the only thing that we found of a significant relationship was a small one between the scrotal circumference EPD and prolificacy. And that's this black line here. And this would be the scrotal circumference EPD. And as it gets larger, the number of progeny per bull did tend to increase to some degree. It didn't explain very much of the variation, which you wouldn't expect one trait to explain very much. I think the thing that is important is that, you know, we have few EPDs related to fertility. So if one does provide some help, then I think that can be important. And obviously, scrotal circumference is also, you know, related to other reproductive traits like, you know, daughter's age of puberty and to the BSE exam. So it may be something that we want to pay more attention to in our selection programs because it is somewhat related to prolificacy. Now, you've seen this slide before. It's the same one where we have week of the calving season and the sires by prolificacy group. And I thought about this for a minute, and the way we measured prolificacy was because we had sampled all of the calves, we just counted up how many calves were in the whole calf crop. And that told us how many calves each bull produced. But in reality, there really isn't much difference in most cases from here on out. All of the difference occurs up here. Okay? So we looked at alternate methods and we said, well, what if we only were able to sample calves from week 2, 3, and 4, or what if we only sampled calves from week 3? It greatly reduced the cost of determining, you know, prolificacy of a group of bulls. So when we did that, we look at this table, it summarizes the results. What this shows is this is the initial assessment. So if a bull was high based upon the entire calf crop, when we looked at only calves born during the second, third, and fourth week, that most of them would still be assigned, 83% of them would still be assigned high, some would be assigned medium, and so that would kind of be incorrect. But the important point is none of them would be called low. And vice versa, none of the low ones would be called high. And even if you only looked at week 3, so all you'd have to do, if you were doing like age and source verification, you'd already know the ages. So you could just sample when you worked calves, those born during week 3. Or if you were planning ahead, you could just mark those calves born during the third week of the calving season. And you could do a pretty good job of identifying at least the bulls that you knew would not likely be low prolificacy. And similarly, you could find bulls that would not likely be high prolificacy. So you wouldn't be able to identify that medium group and so on, but you could help separate things out at a much, much lower cost. Okay, this is the only quiz question. We have to include this in here. And so if you were asking yourself which is the best bull or which bull produces the most income, is it the bull with the highest weaning weight or yearling weight EPD? No. Okay, is it the bull that sires those heaviest calves? Nope. It's the most prolific bull. Okay, that's the most prolific bull. That's the one that generates the most income for the ranch. And certainly, when you have natural service, you don't know which will be the most prolific bull. When you use AI, you know which bull is the most prolific. It depends on what you put in. Now, we did find a repeatability of about 0.33 for prolificacy. So it's moderately repeatable. The Australian study, under very different conditions, the repeatability was about 0.4. So very, very similar there. Just sort of a summary here. Again, the most prolific bulls generated the most in total ranch sales, and that was due to more calves, not heavier calves. You know, prolificacy impacts that genetic composition of the progeny. Weeks 3, 4, and 5 generate the most conceptions, and that's mostly by those highly prolific bulls. They have some traits that in a large group of females, they're able to settle more of those females. There may be opportunities to manage, for early conceptions. You could reduce costs to determine prolificacy by only sampling during selected time periods, just week 3 or weeks 2, 3, and 4. As I said, the repeatability of prolificacy is kind of moderate, and there may be some, there's a small relationship with higher scrotal circumference EPDs, and that are typically replacement heifers come mostly from prolific bulls. But some of them do come from those non-prolific bulls under our circumstances, certainly. I would like to thank a number of contributors and collaborators for the project. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to share the information with you, and thank you for having me here today.